Born in the Hoosier State, came out here as a young, quite young man. Says every time he reads the reports of the weather back in the Indiana area, he says, "Thank you, Father, for bringing me here." I was going to say an awful lot of things about him, but I understand he's pretty well able to speak for himself. And so, again, the Honorable John S. Come in, John.
Look, I'm the judge. My God, another judge? This is about to set AA back for 20 years, I think. Did you ever think 10 years ago that you'd be listening to two judges on a Saturday night? Good evening, my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is John Shea. I am one of God's chosen people, an alcoholic. Now, obviously, that's a play on words. The only thing is, I mean it. And I can say to all of you that I hope before this evening is over, I can convince you that I really feel and believe that we are chosen people of God who have been given the blessing of this program. Now, a little bit about the statistics. First of all, I'm a judge of the Superior Court. That has no earth-shaking consequences except that I am another example of the many examples of the fact that alcoholism is no respecter of persons. It makes no difference how many degrees you have, what your social station in life may be, how much money you've got, how many degrees, all of these things are of no importance when it comes to the disease of alcoholism, because each of us is equally susceptible to it as we are to any other ailment known to man. I might say that I was retired in November of 1966. The diagnosis was alcoholism, chronic acute. In other days, I probably would have just been kicked out and down the road to Skid Row. But because we are making progress in this field, I was retired for disability. And one further note, so that you don't have to ask me questions afterwards, let me say that in September of 1968, I was restored to duty. And since that time, I have been serving constantly and steadily on assignment to the Superior Court of Los Angeles County, and have worked steadily ever since that time. This is one of the miracles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had my last drink on the 13th of February of 1967. My birthday is Valentine's Day, the 14th of February. And God willing, the 14th of February next, it will be 6 years for me. All right. This means the two judges just praised me. You know, Joe is an old buddy of mine. Our paths have crossed down the line, and in the talk I'm about to give, I'll make reference to it. If he's got any corrections he wants to make, I'm not about to give him equal time. I like it the way I tell it. Now, to get this thing off of the ground, I got a little story I like to tell, so I'll break in on it. This concerns a group of fellows who have been getting together at each guy's house once a week to play poker. You know, one of these little social clubs, and every week they get together and they play poker and have fun. And naturally, they talk about things that have gone on during the past week. And one guy in the crowd is rather annoying to the rest of them because he has a habit that every time somebody tells something sad, this guy pops up and says, "Well, I don't know, it could have been worse." And this goes on. It's perpetuated for a long period of time, and it becomes annoying to the rest of the group. So one night they're meeting, and somebody tells of a tragic event that's happened during the past week, and our friend is sitting over there, "Well, I don't know, it could have been worse." And this makes the guy mad. They're going into their cars that night, and he gets around, and he says, "By God, I've heard that for the last time." He says, I've heard it. I don't want everyone to hear this guy say this again. Well, they're all in accord on this. And they cook up an idea. Next week, we'll fix this guy once and for all. We'll have something that happened that'll be so tragic, you'll never be able to say this again. So they get ready for it. And one of the guys is all cocked and fine. So they get to the next meeting, and they're waiting, and this one fellow who's all set, he says, "Hey, did you know what happened to Jim Smith last night?" "No, what happened to Joe?" "Oh, he said, my God, it was terrible. He came home and found his wife in bed with another man. And he went absolutely berserk. He went in and got his gun. He came in, he shot her, and he killed her. He shot the guy, and he killed him. And he turned the gun on himself and committed suicide." They were all flabbergasted. "My God, this is awful." And our friend is sitting over here, and he's shaking his head, and he says, "Oh, boys, that's terrible. But it could have been worse." Well, so when they heard this, they rose up like one man, and they turned on him and said, "My God, man, how could anything be worse than this?" And he shook his head, and he said, "Well, I don't know. It could have been the night before. It would have been me." It sort of depends on your point of view. If that story has any relevance at a meeting such as this, ladies and gentlemen, it lies in the fact that for each of us who acknowledges membership in this fellowship, it could have been worse, believe me. And when I say that, I have in mind the countless thousands of people who are dying, who are living in misery because of the disease of alcoholism. But I have in mind particularly three close personal friends of mine, three men that I have known. I mention these three because I know them, but I know there are countless thousands more. All three of them, attorneys, all three in their early 50s, all three have died within the past 2 years because of booze. So when I say it could have been worse, believe me, I sincerely mean it. And I know how much worse it was for me and it could have been for me, were it not for the miracle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope that I can convey to you some of the tremendous enthusiasm that I have for this program that has brought such a wonderful way of life to all of us. Now, I spent about 40 years gathering source material for this talk. And if I were to try undertake to tell you about all of it, we'd be here much too long, which reminds me I better keep track of the time. At the outset, let me say the first drinking experience of any consequence in my life was way back in the Depression days. I was in my late teens, and I was working for a bootlegger. Now, that really isn't on the prescribed curricula for training for judges. But this was Depression days. Jobs were hard to get. And I got one working for this bootlegger. Now, I wasn't very involved in this bootlegging operation, but all bootleggers had to have a sort of camouflage, see? They had to have a cover-up to conduct their operations in those days. And this fellow had a chicken ranch, and I ran the chicken ranch. Well, back in the back of all the chicken coops and everything, he had all of his skills, you know, the whole bit cooking back there. And I got my hot little hands on a pint of whiskey and a fifth of gin and a half a gallon of wine. So I got my buddies together, and we went out to find out what this stuff was all about. And did we find out? We started out early in the evening, and it immediately developed that they didn't like the taste of whiskey. But I did. I loved it. But they liked the gin. So I drank the pint of whiskey and chased it with wine, and they drank the gin and chased it with wine. Well, we had a large evening, so they tell me. Because I have no idea of what happened. The lights went out very early that night for me, and I had my first blackout. Anything that I know about it was related to me in our hangover the next day. All right, these were depression times. You know the old saying, talk's cheap, but it takes money to buy whiskey. And because of we didn't have money, we didn't have whiskey. But as time went on, I finally got back into school, got into college. And during those days, whenever there was any drinking to be done, I was right up there in the forefront. I always enjoyed it. In fact, I can remember a few times when we used to enjoy them together, Joe and I. Those were later times. In any event, I managed to get into school through law school. And I remember significantly in those days how much fun it was. We didn't. When you're going to law school, it takes a lot of work, so you don't do much drinking. But I can remember after exams, boy, we always went down and hung one on. Those were great days. I'll never forget that I passed the bar in 1941, and we had arranged a party to come to San Francisco to be sworn into the state bar. It was to be on the 15th of December, and a large group of us were going to make a party of it. Well, for those of you who can remember, something happened on December 7th of 1941 that changed a lot of plans. That's known as Pearl Harbor Day. As a result, instead of the party that we'd planned, there were eight of us who took the lark and came to San Francisco to be sworn in as attorneys. Just in passing, I might mention that out of the eight that spent most of our time in the bar car on that trip, three of them are now members of this fellowship. We were in training. Of course, we were in war, and very shortly, I was in Uncle Sam's army. And I remember during the army days, there was a lot of drinking. Significantly, I remember being at Fort McClellan, Alabama. And Alabama was a state-operated liquor store state at that time. And you could go to a liquor store operated by the state and get one bottle. Well, we had to go 80 miles to get to a liquor store. And that just wasn't in the cards. That didn't take care of our thirst. But we found we could go about the same distance over into Georgia and we could get all we want. So once each week, we took turns driving over to Georgia to load up the back end of the car with booze so we'd have our booze for the coming week. Nothing of any great consequence, except it demonstrates how booze became important in our lives. I remember later on, in 1945, I wound up at Port Orr, the port of embarkation. And I ran into a friend of mine who I'd known in school. And naturally, we were in a bar, and all of a sudden the thought struck us, my God, we're going to be on this ship for the next 28 days, and we ain't going to have any booze. We got to do something about it. So we went to a liquor store, bought a case of whiskey, and then smuggled six bottles, each one of us took six, and stuck them in our duffel bag, and smuggled them aboard the ship. Now, this was grossly against the Army regulation. We could have been dishonorably discharged just because of this thing. But the thought never even entered our mind. We had to have our booze. And again, just a little incident to point out how important booze had become in our lives. When I landed over in the Philippines, MacArthur was signing articles in Tokyo Bay, and the war was over. They had no use for infantry soldiers by that time, but they did need lawyers, so I was assigned to the headquarters up in Manila and the claims service. Now, I don't know if any of you know anything about the Philippines, but that Manila, that is a hellhole of the first water. My recollection of Manila is sitting on an army cot, drinking beer, and sweating it out just as fast as you could drink it. That's what Manila is like. Well, you know, if I've got a title for this talk, it has to be that somebody up there likes me. And when I think of it, I think of many instances along the way wherein he has demonstrated how he has his hand on my shoulder. This was one of them because when I was assigned up to Manila, I eventually wound up in Baguio. Now, I don't know whether you know about Baguio or not, but it's what's known as the summer capital of the Philippines, a delightful spot. Going from there would be sort of like going from here up at Lake Tahoe, 8,000 feet in the air, a delightful spot. And I got up there and was stationed in a bungalow on a golf course and enjoying life tremendously. Significantly, I was assigned to process a claim of a large gold mine. Now, they had a claim against the United States government, and I was up there to process this. The most important thing is that the man in charge of the mine was a Scotsman by the name of McKenzie, and McKenzie's property had been acquired by the United States Army. And that's what I was involved with. In any event, McKenzie was trying to get his operation back in business. And he had sent to his headquarters in San Francisco. And he had the first motor vehicle that was delivered to the Philippines after the war. It was a ton and a half flatbed Ford truck. The first thing he did with it was drive to a liquor store and get 25 cases of King George Scotch, which he brought up to Baguio. Well, now, because the Army had demolished his headquarters, and because he had no place to keep it, he brought it up to my place. And I had this cottage with a nice basement Plus, I had one of his refrigerators in my cottage, so that was where we kept the whiskey. And believe me, we had one huge party up in Baguio. All right, the war was over. In 1946, I wound up back in the city of Anaheim, ready to engage in the practice of law. I've had a very unique experience here this evening. I was met by Elsie, who reminds me of the fact that she worked for me back in those days. She gave my memory quite a shock. But I was delighted that she had such glowing memories of me in those days. Be that as it may, I embarked upon my career as a lawyer. In the summer of that year, the city judge retired, and the city council came to me and asked me to take over the job. So I began my judicial career in August of 1946. That's over 26 years ago. All right, in those days, we had a bunch of little courts throughout the state of California. We had city courts, clerk's courts, recorder's courts, Class A, Class B, justice, just a hodgepodge of courts throughout the state. And it was creating a great deal of confusion among the people who were interested in the operation of courts. So we began a court reorganization program, and I became quite active in it. Now, in those days, I was breaking in as a new attorney, and I was getting active in many things. I became active in civic affairs. I joined the Order of Elks. I want to make this perfectly clear, if you know what I mean. I had a great regard for the Order of Elks. I know how much good they do. And if anything I say tonight may sound derogatory, I don't want it to, because I do have a great regard for the Order. But let's face it, they do drink. And that was one of the key considerations that I had in mind when I joined up with them. I became active in that order in the Lions Club, in the March of Dimes, the community chest, all that sort of thing. The things that a young man does when he's getting started in business of this sort. Now, during these days, the drinking was all social. You know, I'd go through, I got stoned once in a while, but didn't everybody? I didn't think anything about it. And from time to time, I'd get rumbles about how much drinking I was doing. One event that stands out in my memory, I had gone to Fullerton Junior College. And so I went back. Now, I had just been appointed as a judge, and I was feeling my oats, starting my case of big shot-itis. And I remember going to a football game. I had a friend who lived a half a block from the stadium, which made it very convenient because I could go to his place and have a close-by parking place for the first thing. But more important, he always had something to drink. So I'd get over there and we'd have a couple of hookers, you know, and then go to the ball game. Well, this particular occasion, I had more than my share to begin with. During the first quarter, I sneaked over and I got another good belt. During the half, I went over and got a couple of more. During the third quarter, I went back and got another one. And I came back. And I had to crawl over people to get back to my seat, you know, and I stumbled and fell. And I'll never forget that raucous female voice that said, "He's a judge?" Yeah. Oh, I'm telling you, some of these people just don't understand. In any event, again, it just demonstrates booze was becoming important in my life. All right. Things were going my way, however. In fact, they were going so well that any time anybody ever said anything to me about my drinking, I'd rear back, "What the hell are you talking about? I can drink you under the table." And, you know, I was convinced that I could. And I guess I was trying. In any event, I had that defensive attitude of somebody who is reminded of the fact that booze does have a little bit of treachery in it, but at that time I wasn't ready to see it. All right, as time went by, I mentioned the fact that of the multitude of courts that we had, and we had the court reorganization program. It was one of the propositions on the ballot, such as you've just been experiencing here last November. And in 1950, a vote was taken in the state of California, and the court reorganization program was adopted, whereby we got rid of that multitude of small courts that we had and established the procedure that we now have. It provided basically for a municipal court, superior court, and our appellate court structure. In the more remote areas, we still have some of our justice courts. And essentially, it meant that lawyers were going to be sitting as judges in most of these courts. Now, I don't contend that lawyers have any monopoly on justice, because I'm sure that they do not. But other things being equal, it's a little bit helpful if the guy that's sitting up in that seat knows a little bit about the law. Now, prior to that time, you see, those courts had been presided over by ribbon clerks, postmasters, insurance brokers, anybody that had an in with a supervisor. So the effect of the reorganization program was to get it administered by men who were trained in the law. Because I was in a district where there were two judges who were qualified for the office, we had an election. And Elsie was reminding me tonight that she worked for me back in the election of 1950. In 1950, I stood election, in 1952, that's when the election was, we had an election to elect the first judge of the newly created Municipal Court of the Anaheim-Fullerton Judicial District. And I was successful in that election. I took office in January of 1953. That's going to be 20 years pretty quick, isn't it? All right, during this time, the drinking was social. I had rumbles from time to time that I was drinking too much. In fact, Elsie reminded me that one of the things that she heard during that campaign was, he drinks too much. And I think her answer was something like, doesn't everybody? In other words, we defend the fellow who uses lots of it. Now, I mentioned the Order of Elks. During that period of time, I had become active and became an officer in the club. And in 1953, I was elected as exalted ruler in my lodge in Anaheim. Now, I liked the Elks Club because, being a judge, it gave me a private place to drink. You see, I didn't think it was befitting for a judge to be out drinking in these public bars, you know. I should keep this sort of sub rosa. Of course, if the Elks Club was closed, I didn't have any hesitancy to go down to one of the local bars and get just as stoned that way. All right, things were going along. And if I had any criticism, and I had it from time to time, I used to roar back and tell them, go to hell, I'm doing all right. I was developing the most magnificent case of big shot-itis that any man ever had, believe me. And it took AA to bring it home to me and teach me what this thing is all about, this word we call humility. In any event, I just brushed them off. In September of 1953, as exalted ruler, I was at a convention in Long Beach. And I received a call from then-Governor Earl Warren, advising me that he was appointing me as Superior Court Judge of Orange County. And I said, thank you, sir. And we had a pleasant conversation. I said, Governor, I haven't had the chance to meet you. I do hope I see you next week at the bar convention. And he said, yes, Judge, I'd like to meet you, too. So we'll look forward to meeting next week at the bar convention. And we hung up, and then we hung one on, believe me. At a convention, we celebrated that event. The next day, the papers came out, and Earl Warren had been appointed Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. So we didn't keep our meeting that week. It was going to be quite some time before I would ultimately meet him. All right, I took over the duties of my new office, and things went very well for me. Because of the activities that I had been engaged in, I became known to some of the people in these high places like Sacramento and San Francisco, where their headquarters are, you know. And in 1958, I was selected as a member of the Judicial Council. Our good friend Judge Babbage has always on that council with me during those years. This is one of the highest honors that can be bestowed upon a judge in this state. The Judicial Council is a body set up by our state constitution, which is designed to study matters pertaining to the administration of justice, to aid and assist the courts in the disposition of their caseloads, to make recommendations to the state legislature for the enactment of new legislation. A very high honor indeed. I served from 1958 to 1962. In that same period of time, I progressed through the offices of the Conference of California Judges, and in 1962, I was elected president of the Conference of California Judges. And may I say, Judge Babbage succeeded me just a couple of years afterwards as president of that organization. I said our paths had crossed before. Again, this is one of the highest honors that can be bestowed upon a judge in this state. to be president of the state organization. All right, I embarked upon my duties and got prepared. Now, the biggest job of the president of the conference is to select committees and make plans for the coming year, and particularly with a view of making plans for the convention that comes to the end of the year. This would be in September of 1963. So I was making plans. Now, our annual conference is held in connection with the convention of the state bar. And this year it was to be held in San Francisco. We had a day of seminar, a day of business meetings, a day of joint meeting with the state bar. And the highlight of the entire affair was our annual judicial reception and banquet. Isn't that a high-toned sounding thing? It's a great little cocktail party and a very lovely affair. In any event, keep in mind now that it's been 10 years since I've talked to Earl Warren on the phone. 10 years since his appointment as Chief Justice. The state bar decided that it would be a good idea to celebrate his decennial anniversary. So they invited Earl Warren and the entire United States Supreme Court to come to San Francisco as their guests in order to honor Warren on his 10th anniversary. And they accepted. Well, here I was, president of the Conference of Judges and their judges, so it was only normal that I should invite them to participate in our function. So I sent them letters, and they accepted. Well, holy smoke, man, we got a big show going on here. The entire United States Supreme Court, with the exception of one who was ill at the time, came to California in September of 1963 to be honored and to honor Earl Warren. All right, in order to make plans for this, I decided it was a good idea to come to San Francisco. So I prevailed upon the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court to assign me to San Francisco during the month of September, where I worked as a judge so that I could be right on the spot to take care of the multitude of detail that come up in connection with an affair of this sort. So I arrived about the 1st of September and undertook my duties as a judge in the San Francisco Superior Court. The first day that I was there, one of the local judges came in and said, "Hey, John, won't you join us for lunch?" Sure, be delighted. I mean, after all, what's more normal and natural? So I went out to lunch with him. And I remember we went to a restaurant. I sat around a large round table. And I think there were probably 8 or 10 of us sitting at the table. Well, you know what happens when you go to a restaurant. The first thing that happens, they, "Would you like a cocktail, you know?" And they all ordered a drink. Well, I said, "Okay, I'll have a drink." So I did. Now, this is of no earth-shaking consequences, except for one thing. Prior to that time, I had had one ironclad rule that I had followed throughout the years. I would never take a drink as long as I had any work to do. Whenever anybody criticized me or said anything to me about it, I'd say, "What the hell are you talking about? I'm doing my job. I never let booze interfere with my work. I'm doing all right." Here I am in San Francisco, not even thinking about it. The thought didn't even enter my mind. Cunning, baffling, powerful. It's alcohol we're dealing with. It never entered my mind. That day I had a drink at lunchtime when I still had work to do. Now, the time of day had nothing to do with it. It used to be if I got through with my caseload at 10:30, I didn't mind having a drink at 10:45. By the same token, if I had a jury out until midnight, I would never take a drink until that jury was in. That's the way I ruled it. But here I am in San Francisco. So what the hell, have a drink. It never entered my mind. The significant thing about it is that there was never going to be a noontime from that time on that I didn't have a drink for lunch. In fact, it got to 2, 3, 4 drinks, and sooner or later it became, I drank my lunch and didn't bother with eating. This is the progressiveness of alcoholism at work. In any event, all during that month, things went great. I was glad that I was there. I was able to make all the preparations, and we came down to the great occasion, and the Supreme Court was out here, and it was truly a wonderful affair. All of our preparations went satisfactory, and everything went off very well. I think significantly of the day of the judicial reception and banquet, because this was the highlight of the whole occasion. I will never forget that day. My first waking thought when I awakened that morning was, I can't take a drink. I've got to be able to perform tonight. And all day long I kept telling myself, I can't take a drink. I've got to be able to perform tonight. And that's the way I got through that day. I didn't know it then, but I was practicing one day at a time. You didn't know that, did you, Joe? In any event, at 7 o'clock, I went down with the rest of them, and I had those two socially acceptable drinks, you know. And then we got up for the show. This was in the Grand Ballroom of the Fairmont Hotel. And this was quite an occasion. Here sat Earl Warren, his wife, the entire United States Supreme Court down this way. And this was quite an occasion. Here sat Earl Warren, his wife, the entire United States Supreme Court down this wing of the table. Here sat Governor Brown, the Chief Justice of California, and all of the members of the California Supreme Court and the officers of the conference on both sides of the head table. And here I am up here running the show. What a show that turned out to be. I mean, after all, how can you fail with a cast like that? It was a tremendous affair. It was very successful, very enjoyable. When it was all over, they were coming up to me, they were grabbing my hand, they were patting me on the back. Great show, John, wonderful deal, best we ever had, you know, that kind of jazz. It was a tremendous occasion, but its significance at this meeting tonight lies in this fact. I know now what I could not possibly have known then. I know now something that I would have vehemently denied then. I know now that on that day, I was a full-blown alcoholic. Cunning, baffling, and powerful? How is it that a man can stand up in this company and perform in this fashion when underneath the disease of alcoholism is eating away just as surely as any cancer or any other disease known to man? The one saving grace about alcoholism is we can do something for ourselves. It was a great occasion. When that was over, I went back to my court in Orange County. And by now, as I've mentioned, I was drinking at lunchtime. And over, I continued. Well, my old rule had been forgotten long ago. You see, these things are things that we don't think of at the time that they occur. It is only in retrospect, when I went back over it and tried to figure how did this thing happen, only then do I realize how it all occurred. All right, now I was going down to the Elks Club every lunchtime, having a few with the boys. Well, that few with the boys. Well, I'll never forget one day I was in court. All of a sudden, somebody's pulling my arm. My bailiff is waking me up in the middle of the courtroom in the middle of the afternoon. Here's a jury over here. Here are the attorneys and the litigants. One of the attorneys happened to be from the Attorney General's office in Sacramento. But you know, you can keep this up. You can put on this show for a while, but sooner or later it's going to get to you. And it was beginning to get to me. In July of 1964, when I say that somebody up there likes me, I have this occasion in mind. Now, I love to play duplicate bridge. I don't know whether any of you know about it, but I find it a very interesting game, very challenging game. And I've become active in duplicate bridge playing. And in July of 1964, we had a double session event at the Elks Club in Anaheim. And because I had an in, I was more or less in command. That meant I was the bartender. And I had the keys and all this stuff. Anyway, we had a delightful day. We had two sessions, one in the afternoon, then we had drinks and dinner, and another session at night. That night, I closed up the place, and by my standards, I was sober. Well, I hadn't probably 20 drinks during the day, so I still knew what was going on. And by my standards, that was okay, see? In any event, I took some people to Fullerton, dropped them off, started for home. And we had a section of freeway there that just been open. I get on the freeway and I'm barreling, and all of a sudden there's something black in front of me. I don't know to this day what it was. All I know, it was right there, and I hit my brakes. I went into a four-wheel lock skid. I was going around, and all of a sudden I see the flash of lights and this horrible crash. And then I moved around and rolled a little bit more, and I wound up, and there was that ominous silence that follows something of this sort. I knew I'd been bounced around inside of my car, and I reached up and I could feel blood on my head. But outside of that, everything was all right. And I crawled out of my car. I was able to get out of it. And I was standing there when out of the darkness came the hoot of the sirens and the red lights and the usual thing that follows an event of this sort. I was taken to a hospital. Fortunately, I came out of it without too much trouble. The next day, the papers came out. Judge, witness says judge driving 100 miles an hour. I blew my cork. What the hell is the matter with this idiot? I never drove 100 miles an hour in my life. I'll sue him for libel. Boy, what I was going to do to that guy. It's just that in looking back, believe me, you don't go into a four-wheel lock skid, cross over a freeway divider. There was no fence between at that time. Crash into an oncoming car and wind up 380 feet down the highway when you're driving 30 miles an hour. When I say somebody up there must like me, I can only say to you that on that occasion it was a fraction of an inch and a fraction of a second between life and death. It just seemed that the old boy wanted me to hang around for a little while. And I like to think that he kept me around so that I could come to AA meetings and talk to you in the hopes that maybe I can get across a message. All right. As a result of this, my family became concerned, and they called my uncle, who lived in Wisconsin. He said, you've got to send him to Hazelden. Now, I don't know whether any of you know about Hazelden or not, but that's one of the leading alcoholic rehabilitation centers in the United States, or the world for that matter. Well-established, been there a long time. And he was acquainted with it, so he arranged for me to go back to Hazelden. Well, I went back to Hazelden during the month of September of 1964. A delightful spot. It's about 40 miles out of St. Paul, way back in the country. Beautiful spot, a nice big old farmhouse with cottages out around the lake. Just delightful. And I was there for 4 weeks. A wonderful place. Now, the program at Hazelden is breakfast, a half-hour lecture, lunch and a half-hour lecture, dinner and a half-hour lecture. And these lectures are all on the subject of alcohol. Alcoholism, all that's known about it. So that the intervening time was spent with alcoholism counselors, with group therapy sessions, with study, meditation, things of that sort, relaxation. By the time I had spent 4 weeks there, intellectually, I knew everything that there was to know about the horrors of alcoholism. And I was delighted that I had been given this opportunity to know how terrible it is. So I spent my time there. I spent four weeks, and it was just wonderful. In the meantime, I had regained clear thinking and sobriety, and I was just delighted. So I bid them farewell, and I went into Minneapolis where I was going to be met by some relatives, and they were going to have a party for me that night, and then I was coming back to California. So I got into St. Paul. It was several hours before I was to meet my aunt. 30 minutes later, I was in a bar drinking. What kind of idiocy is this? For a man who is supposed to have a grain of intelligence, after 4 weeks of thorough and complete education and indoctrination on the horrors of alcoholism, in 30 minutes, I'm into a bar drinking. About that time, the hypocrite in me came out, and I realized, my God, I can't see these people with booze on my breath. They'll know what I'm back here for. So I went to a motion picture show and watched this stupid picture for 3.5 hours before I met her so that I wouldn't have booze. You know, this hypocrisy's powerful stuff if we could just direct it in the right direction. So they had a party that night. They had Cousin John, who was cured now, and Oh, it was a delightful occasion. And, you know, they're way back in the kitchen, sneaking drinks back there. Well, I walked right in. I said, now, listen here. Well, I'm not going to permit you bring them right out of here. It doesn't bother me a bit. Oh, wow. But I put on the good old hypocritical show. In any event, I got back to California. Now, one of the things that they had stressed at Hazelden was attendance at AA meetings. And so they said, when you get back home, you've got to go to AA meetings. Well, I got back to Anaheim. Chad, I'm not going to Anaheim. Everybody will know me. I'm not going to be caught dead in that place. I can't go to Santa Ana. Everybody over there knows me. I don't know whether you know the geography of Orange County or not, but way down at the south end of the county is Laguna Beach. I finally figured out that if I could sneak down to Laguna Beach, maybe I could get to an AA meeting without being caught. So that was my first attendance at AA. Believe me, I fought like hell to keep from joining this organization. I didn't want any part of it. Naturally, it didn't take right away. In fact, I was going to spend 2.5 years fighting to keep from joining this organization. I've frequently said, Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest organization in the world, comprised entirely of members, no one of whom wanted to join in the first place. All right, that was my approach to it. Without going into the gory details, over a period of time, I made the Miller Sanitarium in San Bernardino, the Bishop Gooden Home in Pasadena, another trip to Hazelden, the Rosemead Sanitarium, all of these places. And during this period of time, it got nothing but worse. And there's one thing about education on alcoholism. If it does nothing else, it sure spoils your drinking. Because every drink that I took after that was just like poison. I hated it, and yet I had to have it. I can remember being at Hazelden and seeing that chart that's put out by the National Council. It's sort of like a V, you know, the road down and then the road back up. And I can remember looking at that chart and seeing in there, drinking in the morning. You know, that reservation in the back of your mind, see? Why, an idiot drinks in the morning. Oh, of course, at a convention or a wedding or something like that, but nobody drinks in the morning. Remember how I told you that I would never take a drink as long as I had work to do? But the time came when I did. And so it was with drinking in the morning. Only an idiot would drink in the morning. But the time came when I did. I can remember a morning standing in front of a liquor store at 5:45 in the morning, madder than hell because the guy wouldn't open up and let me in before 6:00. It got so bad that every morning I was stopping at a different liquor store on my way to court. A different one so they wouldn't get any funny ideas. And buying a 1/2 pint of vodka. My God, I hated vodka. I wanted good Scotch whiskey, but the vodka wouldn't smell, see? And 1/2 pint. I used to buy whiskey by the case. I never bought 1/2 pint in my life, but I could sneak that into my pocket. This is the working of an alcoholic. All right, that fateful day in November of 1966 came. A committee of my judges waited upon me and said, John, you either sign this and take a retirement or you're going to be kicked out. That broke my heart. My work meant a great deal to me. I thought it was the most priceless thing in my life. And this was probably the darkest day in my life. I took my retirement. For the next 3 weeks, I was drunk constantly. I wound up in St. Joseph's Hospital in Orange. I was there for 3 weeks. My doctor was an old friend of mine. He had been in my court many times. He had known me for a long time. And he was brokenhearted to see this man destroying himself. And he tried everything that he knew how to get me straightened around. But while I was in St. Joseph's Hospital, now at that time there used to be orange groves around it, here I am in there to be treated for chronic alcoholism, acute. And he gave me ground privileges, which meant that I could walk around the grounds and get a little fresh air. And I'm sneaking through the orange groves to a bar down on Main Street. This is the insidious disease of alcoholism. All right, I got out of there. And during that time, the boys from AA were coming, and they were taking me to meetings, you know, and I was thanking them. Oh, gee, you guys are swell. I'm sure glad I got this boy. Oh, holy smoke. Never believe a word of it. I'll never forget there was a man there making a pitch just about like I am here, you know, and I was listening to him, but he was talking about the beautiful looks on the faces of the people around him. And I remember looking around, what the hell's he talking about? They don't look beautiful to me. They look like all the jerks I've ever seen in my life. There's one thing I've learned in AA. Never have I seen it applied so graphically, so beautifully as I have right here. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Believe me, it's here to be seen if you just get that sodden sensation out of your brain, if you just get rid of the bloodshot eyes. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and it was going to take me a couple of years to know what that meant. All right, I got out of the hospital, headed for a bridge tournament down in Coronado. I got all the way to San Clemente before I bought a bottle. I went in and got a husband. This is absolute idiocy at work. Needless to say, I was off on another drunk. During the next 3 weeks, I have no idea. I know that during that period of time, the only food that I had to eat was on two occasions I had two soft-boiled eggs. The rest of my sustenance was scotch whiskey. I woke up one morning, I was at my sister's. Oh, God, how I hurt. I'll never forget that day, and I hope I never do. I remember the feeling, that horrible feeling. My gut felt like I had a hot rock in there trying to explode. My brain felt like a marshmallow that had been over-toasted and was trying to explode. I can remember the lethargy, the horrible aching, the shaking. I can remember my skin crawling like I had 1,000 centipedes running up and down. Oh, God, how horrible it was. I called out, and I said, please give me a drink. I knew I was at my sister's. I knew I wasn't going to get any booze. She brought me in a beautiful glass of pure golden orange juice. Oh, God, how delicious that was. Beautiful, cool, delicious orange juice, and I swallowed it. And it was so good, so refreshing. But in 1 minute's time, it came back up. And it was as black as any shoe polish you ever saw in your life. That was the condition of my system. Back in the St. Joseph's Hospital, this time my doctor, you know, they give you the needle, they give you the feed, they give you the whole bit. This time my doctor said, John, I'm not kidding you. If this ever happens again, you're not coming back to the hospital. You're going to a morgue. And I said, oh, sure, Doc, I know. Don't worry. It's never going to happen again, you know. Oh, brother. So he said, they've got a program up in the Veterans Hospital in Los Angeles, and I want you to go up there. It's a 90-day program, and I don't know, but let's try it and see if it works. Oh, sure, Doc, I'll be happy to try it, you know. And I, you know, all the back of my mind is sure I'll do anything to make them happy, you know. So I go up to the VA hospital, go through the routine. Well, now I'm receiving a disability retirement benefit. Financially, I'm not hard up. So that I go up there and I know, well, they're not going to take me. That's for the old soldiers, you know, that are down on their luck. For the guys that have no place to go, and they help them along a little bit until they can get back on their feet, and then they shoot them out again. So I go up there. Fairly confident in the fact that, well, I'll make everybody happy. I'll go through the motions, see? So I go up there and go through the routine. Finally, I wind up in the little cubicle, you know, the thing with, there's a desk like this here. And on the other guy is this guy on the other side of the desk is this guy in a white smock, and he's the admitting doctor. So he says, what's your name? John Shea. Occupation? Judge. Judge? He looks up at me. And it seems that he has a legal problem. The next 18 minutes we spent discussing his legal problem. And he stamped that thing, okay, and I was in. Well, I hadn't planned on this. I was trapped. So I wound up in the old soldier's home at Sawtelle. All right.
after all of this experience, the first thing I did when I was there was to find a bar down on Wilshire Boulevard, a half a mile away, where I could walk every night. To this bar where the bartender didn't use the jigger. You know, he poured them like this. Oh, he was my kind of bartender. I'd get stoned every night and back to the VA and sacked out. One day the doctor called me and said, "You've been drinking." And I said, "Yep." "All right, it's all over right now. You're going over and take your antabuse." Now, I'm not trying to sell antabuse. All I can tell you is what happened. I had signed up for this program, which included the taking of antabuse. I'll never forget that morning. It was the 14th of February of 1967. I was walking across this wide expanse of lawn, big, beautiful trees, going from one building to the other. And my mind was going like a computer, you know. I guess it's a computer. I don't know how they go, but it's... You know, I won't swallow the stuff. I'll stick it under my tongue. I'll stick it up behind my teeth. I'll vomit it up. I'll get rid of it. I was just going crazy thinking how I'm going to get rid of this antibody. And they're not going to get me, you see. So I get in there, and the nice little nurse hands me a cup of fruit juice, and I swallow this. And she said, "Now you sign here," and I signed there. And I turned around, and I said, "Where's the interview?" She says, "You've had it." My God, they double-crossed me. If you have ever seen a dog with his tail between his legs, that was me on that occasion. As I say, the 14th of February of 1967, that was my day of surrender. That was the day that I quit fighting. And that was the day I began to live. During the next 8 or 10 weeks, I went through a tremendous lethargy. I was like a walking zombie. I was walking around there, going through the motions, gradually regaining my physical strength. But the lack of booze, the lack of incentive, the lack of anything, I just grew like a zombie. But during that period of time, I managed to pick up a few little things to do around there, and they had some programs going on, and I was going through the routine. And slowly but surely, I regained my strength. Now, one of the activities they had was duplicate bridge games. So I would go in and play bridge, and we had these nice little old ladies, you know, that come as volunteers to help the old boys out, you know, and I was delighted, and we played bridge, and it was a very pleasant occasion. So about 10 weeks had gone by, and this one night, my partner did something that just struck me as being hilariously funny. I can't even remember what it was now, but it just struck me as being tremendously funny. And I broke out into uproarious laughter. Well, you know, all my life I've been noted for a hearty laugh. But when I get out a belly laugh, you can hear it all over the place. Now, you just don't do this in a duplicate bridge game. That's a very intense game, you know. You can really hear that pin drop around there when they're hard at it. So that this almost broke up the bridge game. And they get him quiet, shut him up, get him out of there, you know, that kind of stuff. Well, the bridge game was over that night. The next day was Friday, and I was going down to Orange County on a weekend pass. And I was, well, for some strange reason, normally when I went down, you went down the freeway, and I got out, and that was it. But this particular day, for some reason, I got a different bus. And this bus, instead of going down the freeway, went back up through the hill country, up in through Whittier and La Habra and Bray, if any of you know about that country down there. It was a beautiful day. We were driving along, and I was thinking, gee, I haven't been over in this neck of the woods for a long time. It sure is lovely. And I was beginning to feel pretty good, and all of a sudden I remembered about the bridge game last night. Geez, I damn near broke that game up. Then all of a sudden, I thought, my God, I really laughed last night. When was the last time that I laughed like that? I can't remember. Well, it's been 5 years ago. What's happening? What's going on? Am I really getting over this thing? And then those words that I had read 1,000 times, that I had heard so many times, spiritual awakening. Can this be it? Oh, hell no, this
But I began to dwell upon it. I began to think about it. You know, I don't know how you feel about it, but to me, a spiritual experience, my idea was created by Cecil B. DeMille, you know. The light shines down from heaven and the skies open up and a big voice says, "Come with me, John." That's what I expected. So when this happened, it was so simple, so easy. I thought, oh, this can't be it. But the more I dwelt upon it, the more I began to realize, what kind of a sledgehammer do I expect God to have? How is he going to get through to me? This is it. This is the thing I've been hearing about. All I can say to you is that from the time that I became aware of that, I began to live. I began to feel the vitality in my system, the vibrance in my spine, a clarity in my mind that I had not experienced for years. You know, when we talk about a spiritual awakening, it's hard to visualize just what we're talking about. In order to emphasize the point I'm trying to make, I have a little story I tell about two men who are talking about prayer. And one of them says, "Oh, prayer's for the birds." Well, he says, "I tried it, don't work." And the other fellow says, "Well, I'm sorry you feel that way. What happened?" "Well," he said, I went up to the North Woods with a bunch of my buddies, and we went hunting. We went way back in the woods. And he said, "I got lost. And I was wandering around, and I couldn't find them, and they couldn't find me, and I didn't know where to go, and I was really lost. And the darkness came down, and I got scared. Boy," he says, "I was real scared." And he says, "I started to pray. I prayed all night long, and not a damn thing happened." He says, I don't buy that prayer jazz. The other fellow says, "Well, that's a pretty terrible experience. By the way, how'd you get out?" "Oh," he says, "an old Indian guide came by and let me out." An old Indian guide. Again, I say, what kind of a sledgehammer do we expect God to have? How do we expect him to get through to it? It's no Cecil B. DeMille production. It's a simple thing, like an old Indian guide, or like laughing for the first time in 5 years. All I can say to you is that ever since that has occurred, I have never wanted to take a drink. In fact, I say now, I don't say I don't want to drink. I say I want not to drink. Because I know the meaning of the spiritual side of this program. And ever since that day, I have enjoyed Alcoholics Anonymous. And ever since that time, I have tried diligently to convey this message to anyone who is willing to listen to me. I say to you that out of this experience, I have gained an awareness of the existence and the power of God such as I never dreamed was possible. Now, I'm sure that it would have been nice to have been a social drinker. Certainly, it would have been more socially acceptable. Professionally, it would have been more advantageous. Financially, I would have been better off. Yes, it would have been nice to have been a social drinker. But I say to you with all of the sincerity at my command that if it was necessary, as it seems to have been, for me to endure the physical torture and the mental torment that I did in order to have the relationship that I now have with my God, it was worth it. And I know God can and will if he is such. Thank you.